this is the most, probably the most famous poem of the 20th century. It came out in 1922, and essentially it sort of talks about the spiritual despair of the world after World War I, right, which was a terrible, terrible conflict. Thousands and thousands of people killed, but it came at the same time as really a mechanization was taking over the world. Right? The world it was completely different after World War I than it was before. Before, sort of, it was still a kind of an agrarian, agricultural economy, but electricity was here, the internal combustion engine was there, railroads had been around for a long time, but the car was taking over, and Henry Ford's mass-produced Fords, that date that about 1912. And in the big picture, theorists look at this is a moment of alienation, where before that, at least you're in touch with the soil or the roots, or if you were in Indiana, people picked corn by hand, like that's what you guys did in the summertime. But once industrialization came in, then you had machines. Now, Indiana being not exactly on the cutting edge, these machines didn't get here until about the 30s, all right? It's pretty hard to believe that, the first light bulbs went on in New York in 1880, but rural electrification took a Democratic president like Roosevelt, didn't come to Indiana until the 30s. Right, so you were still living by the kerosene lamp if you were out there in probably half of you were from. So this is a poem about that transition, all right? The people, you feel disattached from things. This is the story of modern life, urban warfare, right? Do you recognize this? You wouldn't recognize it at all. He has this little colophon. It says, I once went to Kumai to see the Sibyl with my own eyes, and I saw her hanging in a bottle. And the little children said to her, Sibyl, what do you want? And this is Greek. That's Latin. This is Greek. Sibyl, S-I-D. You know your sigma, your mathematicians? So you can see S-I-D, lambda, lambda. You all know enough Greek, right? Sibyla, what do you want? And she answered, I want to die. Okay. Do you recognize where that's from? Well, go back to your Petronius, which you read, okay? In the, what page is that on? From the Satyricon? Remember that big drunken dinner party? All right. And I think some guy, remember death was the theme. And no matter how rich this guy was, he got more and more maudlin during the course of the dinner. The drunker he got, the more he started thinking about death until he actually brought his casket out there and climbed in. All right, so that was a heck of a dinner party. They say in Ireland, the drunker they get, the more patriotic they get. But in this, the drunker they got, the more they started thinking about death. So anyway, I don't give you the page for it, but see if you can find it. And here comes the poem. The very famous opening lines, April is the cruelest month, reading lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, strewing dull roots in the spring rain. And this poem, it's sort of a European moment, but it's based on the wasteland myth, which is an Arthurian myth. Okay, the wasteland is the land in the continuations of the Percival story. Remember, he doesn't ask what's the lance and what's the what are these processions, right? And people wrote continuations, and they figured out that it was sort of the world before religion. It was the loss of spirituality, okay? And that's what Eliot's talking about here. If you go through the horrors of World War I, nobody can believe in anything anymore, right? And just everybody's in this kind of despair moment. And that is represented in the Arthurian romances by the wasteland, right? And we left, that story of Percival leaves him searching for answers. Okay, he's on an educational mission, and there's this notion he's got to refine the Holy Grail, which he saw and didn't understand, right? But he never gets there. So this is the perennial search. So Eliot's great metaphor is that we are all in a modern wasteland today, you know, trying to figure out what that Holy Grail or thing is that will keep us going. Now the immediate connection here, and I didn't do this, I don't know if I can do a search. He quotes Dante an awful lot in this. I don't think I can do a search on this text. Let me just do it. Let's see if we can do a search. Oh. Well, that's great. Is there something that's going to clue me to the line? You thought you saw it? A little more? Where? Edit what? Oh, okay. Oh, not that. So maybe I can. Where's the go back button? Open this. Oh, up here. Oh. There you go. All right. So in the third book, which I'm going to get to if the conversation dries up today, in the third canto of Dante, he gets to the gates of hell and he goes in. He sees thousands of souls waiting to cross the river Styx, to be ferried across so they can start their journey into hell. And he says, I did not know death and had done so many. Well, here T.S. Eliot takes that image right out of Dante, an image that's set in hell, and puts it in London. So in case you're wondering what London meant to Dante, okay, you know, it was the hell of modern life. Okay, he looks around the people walking up and down in the city, and he says, I had not thought death had undone so many. Now, they're not dead, the Londoners. They're just as good as dead, as far as Dante, as far as T.S. Eliot's concerned, because they've lost their spiritual reason for being, right? So anyway, this isn't a course on T.S. Eliot, but one of the things that's kept modern literature alive is when the greatest poet of the 20th century, you can argue about it, but that's, I'm not sure that's my opinion, but that's the generally conceived opinion. When he was reading, when he looked for inspiration, he certainly looked to the older literature, all right? And there are other examples of that, but that's enough. A colophon from Petronius, got it right in your book, okay? And a line from Dante. So let me ask, let's turn to page 1457. And take a look at these circles, and I'll put this up for a minute. That's just one of those things that English majors know, and we're just shocked that the rest of the world doesn't know them. Okay, I mean, something as big as T.S. Eliot's inspiration in ancient literature. You know. But that's the way the world goes. That's it. We have the nine circles, and circles eight is divided into subdivisions. So, did anybody pick out I'll just wait patiently. Tell me about one of the sins. Anybody have a favorite sin? Yeah. Okay, so if we look down in the chart here, circle four will be prodigal. And my, what's prodigal mean?
Well, I mean, I would have liked, I never heard it like that before.
Okay, so they're both sins. Spending too much, that's an odd thing to think about, spending too much and spending too little. So Canto 7 is on page 1484. Yeah. All right, so money's on your mind. What are you, pre-med?
No, I'm pre-med.
Okay, that's an old joke. How many economics majors are there in this biology class? Everybody raises their hand. Pre-med. Joke. Go ahead. So what did you see? Okay, so what line are you thinking of? Are they rolling stones in this one?
Yeah.
So here we have some sin, prodigality and avarice, and these people seem to have been guilty of it, and they get somehow appropriately punished. And that appropriateness, this is sort of our interpretation. The Italian critics like to use this word, I don't even know the exact translation, called the contrapasso, okay, the appropriate punishment. And the what makes Dante so interesting is that the punishment never quite fits. All right? Are you with me? In other words, how does pushing stones around in opposite direction fit? So the image of collecting endless wealth, right, that it's not endless, it's endless. Well, once you set on the road to wealth, as they say, it's an endless road. I mean that's what, I don't know if that's my point about Sumner Redstone, age 84. Okay. As wealthy as you can get, right, and still out there trying to make a buck every day. Okay? Because And you could say, you know, maybe you could go teach eighth grade math or something like that in an inner city school, right? Let's get it together, buddy. You've got enough. Everybody hates you. Right? You know, you divorce the wife. You sue YouTube, everybody's favorite website, for $1 billion because they're using Viacom videos on it, right? What else do you want? So you get it. The enormous weights. That's line 27. So let me read it again, starting at 24. So here we are, the avaricious, and the avaricious means the greedy, and the prodigal means spending constantly. And for Dante, they seem to be the same sin. And why would they be the same sin? Yeah. Yeah, it's the concentration of wealth to the exclusion of all other things, and the wealth becomes a weight. Okay, it's like the way you're constantly pushing, you're manipulating it, right? And when you do get to, remember me when you get your first billion, right? Write this down, Heather, because I remember me anyway when you get your first billion. Okay, but you know, you get a lot of worry comes with it, because what else you got to do except worry about losing it, right? Comes in, it goes out. You know, you're all going, well, I'll buy that luxury, you know. But when you get it, it's actually a pretty tough thing to live with. Getting and losing and the burden of worrying about it seems to be what's imaged partially by these stones. So there's the worry of losing it, the futility of it, all that's somehow coming together here. I'm going to pause for 1 second. In Dante's world, in this canto, he does something really interesting. Right? Now, we all know that in Dante's time, again, the world was round, but it was a geocentric universe, so the Earth was at the center, okay, the round Earth, the mountain of purgatory down here, and Jerusalem up on the top, as far as Dante was concerned, and Italy over there, and the Ganges River over here, that was his... thing. Now the next planet out would be what? What are the? What? Yeah.
The moon.
Okay. And then, did they have Mercury? I guess they had Mercury. The Mercury. What's who's next? Venus. And then Earth. Oh no. Then the Sun. Okay. And then Mars. No, not the, yeah, the Sun. Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, right? And when Dante goes up in the Paradiso, okay, he'll jump from level to level, right? Just instead of like 9 levels of sin, okay, you'll meet people on the moon who are paradisial, but not as fully paradisial as somebody in the level of the sun, okay? Or they're not like, you know, way out there and, in the sphere of the fixed stars, okay? That's where the real action happens out here, okay? But Dante's, being a medievalist, he's got everybody graded, you know, first grade, second grade. And you're good, but you're not really good. You don't make it up here, okay? And you know that... and I'm not an expert on this, so I can only do this partially. Each of the planets was thought to influence us on Earth, and they had specific qualities attached to them. This is your kind of basic astrology, right? The stars influence you, but when you're born under a certain planet, you've heard of that. If you're born under Mars, what are you going to be like? What? Yeah, warrior. I thought you said boring. Okay. You know, so Mars is warlike, right? You get it? How about Saturn? Yeah. Venus, there's another easy one, right? Yeah, so that's the loving planet. And that's a good planet. You want the good planets up there in your chart, right? And Saturn is bad, makes you old and craggy. Okay, the image of Saturn is the image we use today for the new year coming in. Saturn's an old man with that scythe and the long hair. That was always an image of Saturn. Somehow it got associated with New Year's and attached to a little baby. But Saturn kind of withers you up, right? Jupiter, is that good or bad? Any idea? What? Power? It's like an old King Cole thing, a jolly old king, a jovial king. Jupiter equals Jove equals jovial. So that's a good planet to have there. Right? So, you know, if you're born under Jupiter and Venus, you're one good time guy. You know, like the frat, they don't even interview you. They check your astrological chart. Okay, they want you, but they don't want you if you're Saturn and Mars. I think Mercury is more complicated than the Mercurial, and the Moon, frankly, I forget. Okay? And the question came up. Dante was the first guy to ask, well, we know this. This was received opinion. And if you're interested in astrology, which doesn't work, but nobody believes me, okay, it all goes, it's actually a very late development. It comes out of the 3rd, 4th century, and it comes out by way of Persia, the Zoroastrianism. It's really about the same time, 2 or 3 centuries before Islam developed, that they were going down a lot of weird paths. And those three wise men who showed up, you know, at the manger, they were sort of precursors of this kind of learning. It's not an ancient art. In other words, we don't turn to Homer for these astrological things, although you can see how the Homeric deities got involved with it. Well, Dante was the first guy to say, well, I understand all the planets, but who's the guardian deity of Earth? And I know if I'm born under Mars, right? Mars is warrior-like. Who's the deity of Earth? And it's in this canto, Canto 7 of the Inferno, that he says, you know, I got it figured out. You know who the guardian deity is?
It's Fortune.
Fortune. And people made up images of Fortune. Usually she's a woman. And often she's got a wheel, like women spun, like a spinning wheel. Right? And you're either up on the top of the wheel, think of a Ferris wheel, right? And if you're up at the top of Fortune's wheel, where's there to go? Yeah, there's nowhere but down, right? This is what this canto is about. When you've got the wealth, there's only one thing that can happen to you. Yeah, you're going to get bad. It's not likely you're going to stay stable, okay? Down is where it's going to, you know, Fortune's often thought to stand on a slippery ball. She's pictured with a sail. The wind blows or doesn't blow. And let's go back to Percival. Do I have the page? Remember Percival? He's walking along and this figure of Fortune shows up in front of him on page. I will find it. Page 1370. There, I'm getting an essay question out of it. Page 1370. Into the king's presence the damsel urged her mule. Never had such a creature come to a royal court. She gave a general greeting to the king and all the barons. But seated on her tawny mule, she addressed Percival alone in these words, "Ah, Percival, Fortune is bald behind, but has a forelock in front." Well, here's a separate iconographic depiction, separate attributes. She's not on a slippery ball here, but her head is bald, and she's got a long forelock, remember? So you get one shot at her. You either grab Fortune by the hair, but if she turns her back and starts to leave, then you can grab all you want. Your hand is going to slip off the back of her head. Okay? So, get born in America, right? That's good. You seized your opportunity, but then you're reincarnated. Look out. I'm joking here. I don't believe in reincarnation. But, you know, we all get that sense of opportunities lost and they don't necessarily come back. All right? So, marry the guy. That's what I say. Anyway, there's the Fortune image. And are you having fun? I mean, this is, I can go on. We can do sort of a little fortune theme here since you brought up Canto 7. Let me just find one. Fortune shows up all the time in ancient literature. Where is it? Oh. Turn to page 2444. Let's go 2439. You ever read Hamlet? Anybody here done Hamlet? Okay, a few of you. But you know it's important. We're not going to be able to get to it this semester, even though whoever put this book together thinks we should. Okay. When Hamlet is moping around in the middle of the play, and his uncle, the king, sends for two guys to spy on him, and their names are Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And they come in, and Hamlet is a little suspicious of those two and says, you know, what are you doing in Elsinore? And they say, oh, we just came to visit you. And Hamlet's gone, you know, thinking, I don't think so. I think my nasty uncle has sent you to spy on her. So if you look at line 218, let's start there, 217, Hamlet says, my excellent good friends, how dost thou, Guildenstern? Ah, Rosencrantz. Good lads, how are you both? Rosencrantz, lying his brains out, says, as the indifferent children of the earth. And then his friend Guildenstern says, happy in that we are not over happy. On fortune's cap, we are not the very button. Okay. Fortune wears a hat. And they are not on the top of fortune's hat. And therefore they're happy. Can you understand why now? Because if you're sitting on top of her head, you got nowhere to go but down, right? At least they're not under her feet, right? Hamlet, nor the soles of her shoe. That's Hamlet's first thought. Oh, you're happy, so you're not on her head. You get it? That'd be too much good luck. That's like the guy, remember, who threw his jewel away into the crown and then the fish brought it back? But you don't want to be at the bottom either. You don't want to be under her feet. And then comes the joke. Hamlet, then you live about her waist or in the middle of her favors. Okay. Hey, that's the good part of fortune to be at. All right. That's the little joke. Right. I'll let you figure it out if you haven't yet. Okay. Anyway, so you get it again over on page 2444. There's just a little speech about the death of King Priam at the end of the Trojan War when all the soldiers get out of the Trojan horse. Right? And Pyrrhus, who's Achilles' son, sets to work chopping everybody up. And at line 450, he kills Priam. His bleeding sword now falls on Priam. Pause. This is supposed to be a lousy play. This is like a grade B flick. And the actor says, and his sword falls on Priam. Pause. Out, out, strumpet fortune. So it's an apostrophe. I call on fortune in this moment of crisis. See, King Priam has died. A mighty king has fallen. This is just the kind of thing fortune does on earth. The mighty go down, right? And he calls her a strumpet. What's a strumpet? A whore, right? So he's feminized. And see, fortune is like that. She smiles on you, but she's lying. Okay? That's what whores do. They say, oh, you're wonderful. Okay. Hey, I believe you. Okay. Out, out, thou strumpet fortune. All you gods in general synod, take away her power, break all the spokes and fellies from her wheel. And so we get this other, the image of fortune's wheel, and the gods should get together and take it away from her so that you can't have these things like people being at the top and falling down. But that's the way the world works on earth. When you get up to paradise, it works differently for Dante. You've got it made. You don't go down anymore. Not right. Once you get to purgatory, it's all up. Okay. And here, the image of the... Anyway, there's a dozen of fortune images there. Anyway, enough yakking. Give me another sin. Who's got one? Thank you for prodigality and effort. Just... giving away too much. Yeah, giving away money. It seems to be to spend excessively. Okay, it's an interesting question. All these things are questions. I wonder, having not, I'd have to look it up in Dante's case, but credit card debt might be a good modern parallel. Okay, Dante, I don't think thought in terms of debt, because they didn't have as complicated a... Well, they had a pretty decent banking system. They didn't have credit cards. But, you know, you're having a good time, you're buying stuff for the wife, right? How do you get into credit card debt? It's usually by being a nice person, picking up the tab, right? Watch the newspapers. Occasionally you get somebody who gets into debt. It's amazing how many times they send flowers to people. You can really rack up the debt. Now, in fact, the real reason for bankruptcies, although you can't tell this to the Republican administration, people go bankrupt because of, they get sudden, unexpected medical emergencies. That's documented. You know, you walk into the hospital and they hand you that bill for $42,000. You know about it. Okay? that'll clip you. Okay? And then the interest on the credit card debt, which is absolutely insane, and it's got usurious proportions that only a bunch of Republicans could inflict on us. I mean, the idea that you could owe 5% one day and 19% the next. In Dante's time, they put you straight in hell for that. Okay, but the U.S. banking industry can get away with it. You guys are prime victims. Okay. The whole housing mortgage thing that's going on now, it could have been handled with a few decent laws. Okay. That you buy your house and then suddenly owe three times what you thought you owed. Not so good. But that's not this class. Right, that's prodigality. I think spending too much for good reasons like gets you into trouble. Okay, avarice is greed. Yeah, it's being stingy with your money. Okay, not spending it. For Dante, they're the same thing. And that's such. It's hard to get your mind around that, isn't it? You just have to think about it. And you know, it's like it's not a perfect fit. And the Rolling the Stones isn't a perfect fit. And you think maybe he knows more than you. So let's take another one. Treachery. Oh, that's good. So if we look down in our diagram on page 1457, we have to go all the way down to the circle. Now, what you want to remember for me, you should know prodigality now, and you'll know treachery. Remember, it's the physical sins are not so bad. Force is, you know, way up in hell, but fraud is way down, and treachery is a form of fraud or deceit. So who did you want to look at? 32. Okay. All right, let's just turn page 1566. So who's down there in the second to last step? Betrayed by kinsmen or guests. Oh, they betray their kinsmen or guests. Okay. They're what's sticking out? The heads. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the being frozen, are you doing a contrapasso? So the punishment seems appropriate. What's an example of somebody betraying a guest, first of all? Okay, so you invite somebody over to dinner and you chop their head off. That's fine. This is much more common in the old days than it used to be, when you didn't have Holiday Inn, right, and you invite somebody to your house. Sir Walter Raleigh was very good at this. I mean, he worked in Ireland. He would invite the local Irish guys and they'd just kill him. You couldn't believe it. It was a nasty bit of work, right? Okay, so the appropriateness of the punishment. Frozen. Explain. Which lines are you looking at? Do you know the name of the guy who's eating the other guy's brain? What? Ugolino. Yeah, so I guess it's the, you know, if you betray someone who's close to you, you're punished by being forever locked together with them. That's the simplest thing, right? And it's in ice because, remarkably enough, Dante's hell is not a fiery place. Isn't that remarkable? I mean, there a few of the circles you go down is fire raining, but it's a local phenomenon. For Dante's imagination, for James Joyce, you know, a good Irish Catholic, the worst thing you could have would be heat and flame if you read Portrait of the Artist. Hell is all flames. But for the Italian imagination, I guess it's more used to the heat. A far more horrible fate is to be frozen. If you read the Italian correspondence from the Renaissance, the idea of moving, you know, going to Switzerland, you know, shoot me first, right? It's too icy up there. I get cold easily, right? Right? You go to Italy, that's all they say. You know, troppo freddo, è freddo. Everybody's freezing all the time. All they do is come around and say it's cold, okay? Because they don't have central heat, so you get down to like 40 degrees and you are cold. So anyway, Dante's hell was a place of frozen ice at the bottom at the worst moment. But the proximity is the issue. I want to just mention Ugolino since you brought him up. Any of you been to IU, to the student union building? Yeah? You ever go in the back entrance way that sort of goes out toward that woody park they have there? And there's a big statue there. It's a beautiful statue. It's a giant statue of Ugolino. Next time you're in the IU student union, check it out. Okay. Ugolino, who he's the guy, actually, he eats his children, isn't he? I'm getting mixed up here. Yeah, he's the, isn't it? He's eating the Archbishop Ruggieri. Let's take a look at that. It's a favorite passage. Line 124, 124. You want to read it? Go ahead. So he asks him for his story. Unbelievable. You're eating the guy's head. Tell me why. Right? And Ugolino tells his story in Canto 33, which is the very bottom of hell. Right? So let's, we might as well look at that. You want me to read it or you want to read it? Go ahead. Lifting his mouth from his horrendous meal, this sinner first wiped off his messy lips and the hair remaining on the chewed up skull. That's his napkin. like a snuff movie or something. Then spoke, "You want me to renew a grief so desperate that just the thought of it, much less the telling, grips my heart with pain? But if my words can be the seed to bear the fruit of infamy for this betrayer who feeds my hunger, then I shall speak in tears. I do not know your name, nor do I know how you have come down here, but Florentine you surely seem to be, to hear you speak. First you should know, I was Count Ugolino, and my neighbor here, Ruggieri, the Archbishop. And now I'll tell you why I'm so unneighborly, put it mildly, that I, trusting in him, was put in prison through his evil machinations, where I died. This much I surely do not have to tell you. What you could not have known, however, is the inhuman circumstances of my death. Now listen, then decide if he has wronged me. Through a narrow slit of a window high in that mew, which is called the Tower of Hunger, took place in Pisa, okay? You know the Leaning Tower of Pisa? Tower after me, and I shall not be the last to know that place. I had watched moon after moon after moon go by, when finally I dreamed the evil dream which ripped away the veil that hid my future. I dreamed of this one here as lord and huntsman, pursuing the wolf and the wolf cubs up the mountain which blocks the sight of Lucca from the Pisans. Lucca's the next city up the coast. With skinny bitches, well-trained and obedient, he had out front as leaders of the pack Gualandi with Sismondi and Lanfranchi. A short run, and the father with his son seemed to grow tired, and then I thought I saw a long fang sunk into their sides, ripped open. When I awoke before the light of dawn, I heard my children sobbing in their sleep. You see, they too were there in the prison, okay, where he's locked up. His children were put in, asking for bread. If the thought of what my heart was telling me does not fill you with grief, how cruel you are. If you are not weeping now, do you ever weep? And then they awoke. It was around the time they usually brought our food to us. But now each one of us was full of dread from dreaming. Then from below I heard them driving nails into the dreadful tower's door. With that, I stared in silence at my flesh and blood. I did not weep. I turned to stone inside. They, that's the children, wept. And my little Anselmuccio spoke, "What is it, Father? Why do you look that way?" To them I held my tears back, saying nothing. All of that day and then all of that night, until another sun shone on the world, a meager ray of sunlight found its way to the misery of our cell. And I could see myself reflected four times in their faces. The poor kids. I bit my hands in anguish, and my children, who thought that hunger made me bite my hands, were quick to draw up closer to me, saying, "Oh, Father, you would make us suffer less if you would feed on us." Isn't that, it really always strikes the imagination when you get those cannibal moments. You take it from us. You take it from us, in other words, our flesh. I calmed myself to make them less unhappy. That day, we sat in silence. And the next day, oh, pitiless earth, you should have swallowed us. The fourth day came, and it was on that day my gatto fell prostrate before my feet, crying, "Why don't you help me? Why, my father?" There he died. Just as you see me here, I saw the other three fall one by one. As the fifth day and the sixth day passed, and I, by then gone blind, groped over their dead bodies. Though they were dead, 2 days I called their names. Then hunger proved more powerful than words. Then grief, excuse me. He spoke these words. Then glaring down in rage, attacked again the wretched skull with his teeth sharp as a dog's and as fit for grinding bones. So line 75 is kind of the key. Then hunger proved more powerful than greed. So what do you think that means? And ate the kids. Now he doesn't say he ate the kids. So you can always, you know, come up with an interpretation. But that's the sort of obvious meaning. But it's not clear, right? You're making a leap when you say that. Oh, Pisa, blot of shame upon the people of that fair land where the sound of sea is heard. Anyway, I don't have time to go. Actually, this is the second to the last. That's a great moment. So let's go back to Kelly's scene. So now that you know who this guy is, and let's look again at the end of Canto 32, because it's a famous description, line 127. 124. Soon after leaving him, I saw two souls frozen together in a single hall. So that one head used the other for a cap. As a man with hungry teeth tears into bread, the soul with capping head had sunk his teeth into the other's neck, just beneath the skull. And this is how, so this is going on all the time. The timeless thing. Titus, in his fury, and this is a comparison to another guy in another literary work, the Thebaid by Statius, who will become actually Dante's guide in the Purgatory, another Roman poet like Virgil. In his story of the Thebaid, there's a guy named Titus, and that's where he comes from. Titus, in his fury, did not gnaw the head of Menalippus with more relish than this one chewed that head of meat and bones. Right? Now you got me. I can't resist this. Okay, fall asleep, see if I care. But this guy Statius is after Virgil, like the second big Latin poet. He's not real as famous, but he becomes a character in Dante. Clearly Dante read this story. It's called the Thebaid, or the Seven Against Thebes. And I translated it from Latin a few years ago. It just came out in paperback, but you don't have to read it or anything like that. But I can't resist, since it came up. You were not a plant, all right? I thought we'd look at the scene where Titus gnaws the head of Menalippus, okay? Now, what the story is that the two sons of Oedipus, Polynices and Eteocles, become the rulers of Thebes, but they can't get along, so that they decide to alternate the rule of Thebes, and Eteocles will be king for a year. Remember, Oedipus got his eyes put out. He's down in the basement, right? So his kids are taking over. And so Eteocles will be king for a year, and then Polynices will get his year. The problem is, after a year, Eteocles says, I like being king, okay? I'm not giving up the realm. So his brother, Polynices, goes off to Argos and enlists, like, six guys, other guys, and they become the Seven Against Thebes. And they come to try and demand that Polynices be given the rule, and it's a big war of brother against brother. Right? It's a famous Greek tragedy that gave this myth, and then among the Roman poets, Statius retold the story. But one of these guys is named Titus, and he's the best friend of Polynices, and he's really well described because he's short, right? And so you know this kind of guy. He's one of those guys who, like, wrestles in 136 pounds but has these huge forearms. That's Titus. Like, other people throw the discus or are good with a sword. He's a wrestler. And he's short, so when he gets under you, you know, you're dead. You can take down a big guy. And he's really fabulously described. His problem is he gets real angry. And he doesn't know when to stop. So he has so much fun in battle, he wears himself out. And that's what happens. He's like the sixth of these seven heroes who attack Thebes. They all die one after another for various reasons, because they're all sort of overachievers. So I thought you'd read this. And this is where, in this one time in the class, you can go right to sleep. But I can't resist. So here you go. This is at the end of a hard day killing people, right? But he could sense the heavens dim. Extreme coldness came over him, his great strength waned. He leaned along the ground and cried, "Do what I ask, Inachidae. Don't take my bones to Argos or Aetolia. I don't care for final rites. I hate these useless limbs, this fragile body that deserts my soul." Oh, maybe I should read this. This guy, Menelaus, had put a spear into him, okay? And that killed him, and he's dying. And he gets so angry, sends his soldiers over. Go give me that guy's head. He's over there, the guy who threw that spear, and they bring the head over, and he's looking at it, okay? But he knows he's going to die. And then, you know, he's such a tough guy. I don't want to be buried, you know. Would there were someone to retrieve your head, your head, O Melanippus. I am certain you lie dead in the field and that my final action succeeded. He sort of dying through his spear and killed the guy. Go, Hippomedon, if you have any blood of Atreus. And Parthenopaeus, go, already famous in your first war. And Capaneus, now greatest warrior among the Argives. Each hurried. Capaneus, first in motion, first to find Melanippus, bent and lifted him, breathing from the dust, and carried him on his left shoulder as his open wound poured streams of blood and gore along his back. Like Hercules, when from Arcadia's cave he brought the captive boar to clamoring Argos. Titus sat up and turned his face, and mad with joy and anger, saw his gasping face and glancing eyeballs, and he saw himself. He had the head cut off and set before him. His left hand gripped the gruesome, hated object, and he enjoyed its warmth, while its wild eyes flickered with wonder. He's basically says the guy's still alive. Who would they be closed? Titus was happy, but unfortunate. Vengeful Tisiphone, she's the goddess of fury, demanded more. And in this scene, Statius doesn't show directly what happens. He has to sort of guess. By now, Tritonian Pallas, the goddess, had assuaged her pliant father, that's Jupiter, and was carrying immortal fame to Titus. When she saw that blood and broken brains perfused his jaws, that slime and filthy stains befouled his face, his comrades could not stop him. The fierce Gorgon stood there with outstretched hair. She's got all these snakes, and they're all standing up. And her horned serpents stiffened and cast their shadows on Athena. The goddess turned her face away and fled. Nor did she enter heaven till her eyes had undergone purgation, mystic fires, ablutions in the guiltless stream, Elysis. That's it, okay? So what was he doing that even the goddess of war couldn't watch, right? Right, he's eating the guy's head, as you know, because the blood is on it. And that Dante loved that scene, all right? So he saved it up for this. So we have Ugolino eating the Archbishop Ruggieri's head, just the way Titus ate the head of, and for those of you who are experts, in Italian, in this Latin, he's named Melanippus. And then in Italian, he's Menelippus. And the N and the L gets turned around because things happen in the transmission of manuscripts, right? So, treachery. We got prodigality, we got treachery. Give me another one. I don't know. I guess Herman Wells was such a president of IU. He read Dante. These guys are, you know, a lot of freshmen went through the Dante course. What? I don't know. I don't remember it. Oh, come on. Pick a number. 23? I haven't prepared 23. Let's go back. If you don't have any other one. Let me go back to Canto 3. Let's do just finish yesterday with the last day's assignment since I had to rush off. You want to hear the Lancelot kissing Queen Guinevere? I brought that. It's like nobody knows this passage. Remember at the end of Canto 5, Francesca says, we were reading the story of Lancelot and how he kissed Guinevere, and that's what set us off. Okay, so this isn't, I've never read this aloud to anybody. It's kind of weird. everything's weird. And we have this guy, remember, Lancelot is a real bumbler. He's like a hick from the sticks, you see. But he's a big, powerful knight, but he doesn't know how to behave in front of the ladies. And he's brought, but the queen is taking, Guinevere is taking a real passion for him. But, you know, you can't just bring the guy into society. So there's this man named Galahalt, who's very gallant and knows all the ways of the court. And he's trying to arrange this bumbler, Lancelot, to kiss the queen. And of course, there's another lady, the Lady of Marholt, and she's really hot for Lancelot herself, but the queen will, like, whack her in the head if she gets in the way. So we have a little jealousy going on, too. Right? Let me just read. "My lady," he said, and I think this is Galahalt. "For them I did what I ought, and for you what I could. Now tell me," I think it's Lancelot. "Now tell me all the knightly deeds that you have done," she says. "For whom did you do them?" And Lancelot says, "For you, my lady." "What," she said, "do you love me so much?" "My lady," he said, "I do not love myself or anyone else as much." "And then since," she said, "have you loved me so?" "My lady," he said, "since the day I was called a knight, but was not one." "And by the loyalty you owe me, where did this love which you have bestowed on me come from?" As the queen was saying these words, it happened that the lady of the hill of Malahot coughed quite deliberately and raised her head, which had been bowed. He noticed it immediately, having often heard her, and he looked at her and recognized her, and he felt such fear and anguish in his heart that he could not reply to what the queen was saying. He began, this is Lancelot, to sigh very heavily, and tears ran down his cheeks in such floods that the samite, the silk that he was dressed in, was wet down to the knees. And the more he looked at the Lady of Malahot, the more unhappy he became. The queen noticed this and saw that he was looking very piteously towards where the ladies were, and she spoke to him. "Tell me," she said, "where did this love which I am asking you about come from?" He made a great effort to speak as best as he could and said, "My lady, from the day that I mentioned to you." "How was that then?" she asked. "My lady," he said, "you caused it when you made me your friend, if your lips did not lie to me." "My friend," she said, "how was that?" "My lady," he said, "I came to you when I had taken leave of my lord the king, fully armed except for my head and my hands, and I commended you to God and said that I was your knight wherever I might be. And you said that you wished me to be your knight." You can see Paolo and Francesca sort of looking at each other. They're reading it. "And you said that you wished me to be your knight and your friend. Then I said, go with you, my lady. And you said, go with God, dear friend. That has never been out of my heart since. That was the word which will make me a man of valor, if I am to be one. Since then, I have never been in such dire straits that I did not remember that word. That word has comforted me in all my troubles. That word has protected me from all ills and saved me from all dangers. That word has satisfied me when I was hungry. That word has made me rich whenever I was poor." In faith," said the queen. "That was a word fortunately spoken. And the Lord be praised for having made me say it. However, I did not take it so much in earnest as you did. And I have said it to many knights and only meant it as a manner of speaking. And your thought was not unworthy, but sweet and gracious. And it has brought you good, for it has made you a man of valor. Nonetheless, it is now the custom for knights to make a great show to many ladies of something which means very little to them in their hearts. And your bearing shows me that you love one of those ladies there. I do not know which, more than you do me, for you have wept with fear because of it, and you dare not look straight at them. I can tell that your thoughts are not so much of me as you are making out. By the loyalty you owe me, by the loyalty you owe the person you most love, tell me which of the three you love so." "Ah! My lady, by the Lord's mercy, as God is my true witness, none of them ever had possession of my heart." "It is no use," said the queen. "You cannot keep anything from me, for I have seen many such affairs, and I can see that your heart is there, although your body is here." She said this to see how she could worry him, for she would have been sure he had no thought of love except for her, even if he had done nothing for her sake but the day of the black armor. But she took great delight in seeing and hearing his discomfort. He was so upset that he nearly fainted, but fear of the ladies he was looking at stopped him. And then the queen feared it herself, seeing him change color, and she took hold of his collar to stop him falling and called, "Galahalt!" He sprang up and came running over. He saw the state his companion was in and felt the greatest possible anguish in his heart and said, "Ha, my lady, tell me for the Lord's sake, what is the matter with him?" The queen told him what she had put him to, Ah, my lady, said Galahad, by the Lord's mercy, you could well take him from me by such distress, and that would be a very great misfortune. Indeed, she said, I certainly would, but do you know why he has done such deeds of arms? No, indeed, my lady. If what he has told me is true, it is for me. My lady, he said, as God is my true witness, you can certainly believe it, for just as he is more valorous than other men, in the same way his heart is truer than the others. Where the hell's the kiss? I thought I had it marked. Want to hear more of this? It's within the next few pages. Well, eventually she kisses him. Let's skip that. My lady, said Galahad, many thanks. Now, though, an initial guarantee is needed. Whatever you propose, said the queen, I will do it. My lady, said Galahad, many thanks. Kiss him in front of me, then, as a start to true love. Says the queen, I do not think it is the time and place for kissing at the moment. I do not doubt that I am just as willing and eager for it as he is, but those ladies are there, who are very much wondering what we have been doing for so long, and they could not fail to see it. Nonetheless, if he wishes it, I shall gladly kiss him. Galahad was so delighted and overwhelmed that he could only answer, my lady, many thanks. Or Lancelot says that. Ah, my lady, said Galahad, do not doubt his wishes, for he is all for it. And rest assured that no one will notice it, for the three of us will move close together as if we were conferring. Now, why should I make you beg me, she said. I desire it more than you or he. The three of them moved close together and pretended to confer. The queen saw that the knight did not dare do more, so she took him by the chin and kissed him for quite a long time in front of Galahad, so that the lady of Malahad knew she was kissing him. And then the queen, who was very wise and a worthy woman, began to speak. Well, that was how it was done circa 1270, if you were a queen. Okay. You had to kiss somebody right in front of everybody. That was the big moment. Right. This is a story. This is an anonymous story. It's called The Prose Lancelot. It's in like 12 volumes. It was a sort of the soap opera of the day. It's sort of like that old movie, The Sheik. You know that one? They used to have these 8-reel movies in the 20s. Rudolph Valentino played the Sheik. And he would finally kiss the girl in like reel 8, like 3 hours into the movie. That's what this is about. Let's go back to Canto 3. That was there to explain the end of Canto 5, the story of Paolo and Francesca. The end of Canto 2, I went very fast through and said that Dante had been saved in his moment of despair, whatever it was, by this woman named Beatrice, okay, who delivers him. And you can feel the narrative pattern very similar to that of the Lancelot, where the queen, who have a despairing Lancelot who doesn't know what to do, and the queen gives him a kiss and sort of makes up to him. Well, Dante goes through the same kind of relationship with Beatrice, but and it's confusing because she's sort of a real person, but she's also symbolic. But she has died and is up in heaven with these other ladies. When she sees Dante in trouble, can't get up the mountain, and reaches down through a series of intermediaries and has Virgil then guide Dante through his education. And the ladies she confers with, I'm on page 1470, she identifies herself as Beatrice at line 70. Okay. Virgil is telling the story about how Beatrice came down to him and told him to go help Dante. And she says at line 70, I am Beatrice who urges you to go. Are you with me? I come from the place I am longing to return to. That's heaven. Love moved me, as it moves me now to speak. So this is the kind of religious love as opposed to this carnal love we get in the stories here. When I return to stand before my Lord, often I shall sing your praises to him. And then she spoke no more. And I began, O Lady of Grace, says Virgil. through whom alone mankind may go beyond all worldly things contained within the sphere that makes the smallest round. Your plea fills me with happy eagerness. To have obeyed already would still seem late. You needed only to express your wish. But tell me how you dared to make this journey all the way down to this point of spacelessness. Remember, Virgil's down there in limbo where the pagans who haven't been baptized live, right? Which will be the fourth circle, the fourth canto, excuse me. Away from your spacious home that calls you back. And Beatrice says to him, because your question searches for deep meaning, I shall explain in simple words, she said, just why I have no fear of coming here. Normally, ladies don't go down to hell after they've been in paradise. Right? A man must stand in fear of just those things that truly have the power to do us harm, of nothing else, for nothing else is fearsome. God gave me such a nature through his grace. The torments you must bear cannot affect me, nor are the fires of hell a threat to me. A gracious lady sits in heaven grieving for what happened to the one I send you to. That gracious lady is Virgin Mary, right, who has become more, gets more and more important in Catholic circles in the Middle Ages. And her compassion breaks heaven's stern decree. So Beatrice is released from paradise and gets to go down to hell because Mary said she could do it. Right? She called Lucia, and making her request, she said, you're faithful, but Mary didn't talk directly to Beatrice. She has an intermediary. This is a very medieval notion. Nobody talks directly. Right? You always have to have a third person. Lancelot can't kiss Guinevere. You got to have Galahote there. It's the three of them, right? It's this whole notion of how you get from one phase to another. So fascinated the medieval mind. It's called the tertium quid, or the third thing. You can't go to God directly. You got to have an angel or something like that, or a priest. Somebody has to intercede for you. There's no direct contact. So Mary calls Lucia. She called Lucia, and making her request, she said, your faithful one is now in need of you, and to you I now commend his soul. Lucia, the enemy of cruelty, hastened to make her way to where I was. This is Beatrice talking, sitting by the side of ancient Rachel. So as I count them, we got at least four women here, right? Mary, Beatrice, Lucia, and Rachel. And said to me, Beatrice, God's true praise, blah, blah, blah. Now, why do we mention Rachel? Okay, and you have a little footnote saying she signifies contemplation. Which is true. In the Middle Ages, they go back to the story of Jacob, right? And you have Leah and Rachel. And Leah was another wife of Jacob. But she was the one producing all the kids. And Rachel was barren for a lot of the time and very envious of Leah. So symbolically, people say, we can figure out what this means in the Bible. We sitting here in Italy or France in 1100. Leah represents the active life. Some women are meant to be mothers and to participate in PTA and stuff like that. Whereas Rachel is the contemplative life. Some women are scholars and go to graduate school and write books, or become monks or whatever. Okay, live in a monastery and pray to God all day long, but they don't have kids and things like that. So there was sort of two choices. It's just like the Venus and the Diana choice in ancient myth. Here was the active life and the contemplative life. So she's sitting there with Rachel. Okay, does that mean that Beatrice is therefore sort of the active element, as opposed to Rachel, who's the contemplative element? Or is the footnote even correct? Do you remember who Rachel's son was? Yeah, Joseph. She's the mother of Joseph. Okay, so this is a pretty powerful choice here. This is like the chosen, we're choosing important people, right? Joseph's the sort of ancient ancestor of the Hebrews, and here Dante is clearly the chosen person. But this seems to me really interesting. If I re-ask the question, are women given important roles in medieval literature, say, as opposed to ancient literature? Okay? And a lot of you defended Penelope and stuff like that, but a lot of you wrote essays saying, you know, women really took it on the chin in ancient times. Okay? And you could probably argue that they took it on the chin in medieval times too, but you'd have different evidence for the other side. Here there's an elevation of these women to extreme spiritual importance, right, in Dante's life. I mean, he can't figure out his own relationship to God except through the intercession of at least four different women who represent stuff. So you may want to argue that they're not really women, okay? But on the other hand, you might take the other argument that they're extremely important, okay, for whatever reason. Well, she sends, the basic message is Beatrice sends him off, okay? And he's got the help at line 124 of three such gracious ladies. Which is interesting because there were four mentioned, right? So just standing here now, I'd say, maybe Rachel isn't an active force prompting Dante's journey here. But he's being prompted by Beatrice, who means beatitude, the thing he's looking for, the connection with God. Lucia, whose name means light, okay, who's some kind of God symbol. And the Virgin Mary, that takes care of itself. I don't need to interpret her, right? So Dante starts out in line 132. I spoke like a man set free of fear. Oh, she, compassionate, who moved to help me. And you, he says to Virgil, all kindness and obeying quick those words of truth she brought with her for you. You and the words you spoke have moved my heart with such desire to continue onward. Where he'd been a coward before, been afraid to go to hell, afraid to learn. He'd been afraid to learn or to make his spiritual point. Now he's ready to set out on his journey of education. Now he's ready to see things and to learn them. Right, so I didn't get to camp up for him. That's all right. Canto 3. And then he passes through the gates of hell at the beginning of Canto 3. And the gate says, Abbandonate ogni speranza voi che entrate. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Okay. So look for your emails. And because if I give you study hints, they'll be coming on the email, right? So I've had a request for them. You haven't? Where have you been? Slacking? Is that what you said? Which one? Oh, yeah, go ahead, give it to me. I'll take it. You should have read it out. Yeah, I'm not here. Now, tomorrow, Monday, that's a good time. Do you want to email me? Okay, yeah, email me, we'll set up a time. I need Tuesday morning. I get back Friday, so, but you want it before the exam, I guess. Yeah, okay.
I know I miss tons of important
Melinda.
Things. But, wow, you actually know who I am.
Yes, you're one of the three people I know.
Because I told my husband he doesn't.